This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to a special edition of Progressive Radio, which we're taping live at the Barrymore Theater here in Madison, Wisconsin. My guest this week, right here on stage with me, historian Peter Kuznick and Oscar-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone. They've done this amazing collaboration both in print and on Showtime, their book and their documentary series of the same name, The Untold History of the United States. Peter, why don't you tell us how you two got together for this collaboration?
Well, Oliver and I met back in 1996. I was teaching a history course called Oliver Stone's America for the first time. We were using all of Oliver's movies to get at recent American history and giving different interpretations. So I invited Oliver in to come and talk, and Oliver came in. We had a great session with the students, and afterwards we went out to dinner. And I told him we have an idea for a movie he's got to make. And I laid out the story about Henry Wallace and the atomic bomb. And Oliver said, "Peter, that's an effing brilliant idea. Let's do it." And that's how we started. And we tried to get the movie made. We weren't able to do that movie, but we stayed friends over the years. Oliver kept coming into class. We'd get together. And then in 2007, he was in Washington scouting locations for his movie Pinkville about the My Lai Massacre. And we got together for dinner. And over dinner, Oliver said, "Let's finally do it. Let's do a 60 or 90-minute documentary about Henry Wallace and the atomic bomb." I said, "Okay, that's a good idea." And then he asked me to meet him in New York 2 weeks later. And when I met him in New York, now it was a 10-hour, 10-part documentary film series. So I thought I could do it during my sabbatical year. It took us 5 years that we worked on this on and off because we were doing other projects for 5 years. So it turned into this major project. We actually have 12 chapters, 10 were shown on Showtime, and 2 more are going to be in the box set that we're going to hopefully come out with this summer.
And Oliver, why were you interested in this collaboration?
It was, it's things happen in your life. You get to a place where you meet a historian who tells you things that open you up to the past. And you get to a place where you want to know about your past. I lived from 1946 to now, and I grew up at the dawn of the atomic age. I grew up in New York City. My father was a stout Eisenhower Republican, very anti-New Deal, very anti-Roosevelt. And I grew up in a privileged place. I went to Yale, and I was a conservative and Goldwater man in 68 at school, and I dropped out of school, and I went to Vietnam as a soldier. And, of course, that rocked my world. Many other things did, too. And when I came back from that war, over the next 10 years, I would say it was not a radical transformation, but over the next 10 years, talking to people at another level of experience, I felt huge changes in my life, enormous. And by the 1985, actually 18 years after the war, my war experience, I went back to Central America with Richard Boyle, freelance journalist in Central America. He took me to the major countries, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Salvador, and Honduras, and Costa Rica. And I saw felt the same presence coming down. Up until 1984-5, Reagan was going to invade in Nicaragua. He was going to war there to prevent this revolution. I felt very similar. And I felt bad about it because all the death squads and the killings and the paramilitary, everything I learned down there, I put it in my fictional movie based on Boyle's life called Salvador, which came out in 86. But my feelings were really much more agitprop, disgusted with Hollywood, angry about where we were going back to after having this experience of Vietnam, to go back and relive it again. I felt like I was a stupid person. And ever since 1985, I've been devoting myself to learning more, and all these films brought me closer. But until I started to really, these last 5 years have been opening my eyes, and it starts with the Wallace story, and it starts with this damn atomic bomb, which we can't get away from. It's our founding myth.
To what extent is it the founding myth? I mean, a lot of your work is about American mythology, and the mythology predates the bomb, of course.
If you accept that we had to drop the bomb, it makes the whole thing like a neat package. World War II ends, we drop the bomb. You can accept that, and you can live with that, and it makes life easier to be an American newsman, to be part of the establishment, to accept that America is the good guy, the benevolent guy. And as Hillary Clinton recently said, you know, hey, we're great because there has been no World War III since World War II. So on those conditions, I can say, I'm happy, I go back to sleep. However, if you accept, as Peter and I do, and many people do, that the bomb need not have been dropped, that it was basically not only morally reprehensible, but that it was strategically unnecessary. And once you accept that into your conscience, you have to become a little closer to what Dorothy Day is talking about. So you have to have great qualms, not only about the end of World War II, but about who's who here in this world stage that we've developed over the last 70 years. And the answer is, as we see through the whole series, chapter by chapter, the evidence is overwhelming in the fact that it's the United States of America, which is the heavyweight boxer here in the ring with some light heavyweights, and we are kicking the shit out of people all over the world. But it's not just against communism, it's against the Third World. And that increasingly bothers me as I get older and older, and it increasingly bothers me on an everyday, irritable basis where I can't even pick up a newspaper without getting upset. So it does rock my world.
And the point we make here in this episode is not just that it was terrible that we did it and that hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians were killed, but that Truman knowingly started a process that could end life on the planet. He was aware of that. He said this on numerous occasions. People don't get that. You know, even the critiques of the bomb don't establish that fact. And we're pointing that out because we're showing the fallibility of these leaders. And it's not just a Truman. He's not an evil guy. He didn't glory in the bloodbath. He wasn't evil in that way. He wasn't a Hitler. But none of these presidents should have the power, the veto power of the future existence of the human species. And they do. And other leaders in other countries do. And that's what we're trying to get out. As we say at the end, the fallibility of human beings, the tragic nature of humanity.
And in your book, you point out in the last chapter that these nuclear weapons are still on hair trigger alert.
Yes, which is thousands of them are still on hair trigger alert. You know, we're not even enemies with the Soviet Russia anymore. They target us and we target them with thousands of nuclear weapons still.
But I want to get back to this question about American exceptionalism, because that is one of the main thrusts of both the Showtime series and your book, this idea that the United States is always the good guy and, you know, the one indispensable nation, as both Obama and I think Madeleine Albright said.
The Madeleine Albright quote is worth saying to people in case they don't know it. Madeleine Albright said, if we use force, it's because we're the United States. We're the indispensable nation. We see farther and stand taller than other nations. And then Clinton trumpeted that again recently. He said, we're the indispensable nation.
Yeah, Obama said that.
I mean, Obama, Clinton too, and Obama.
Well, it's psychology too. You know, how can you get out on a political stage and we're running for office and these two guys, Obama and Romney, they were standing up there and you cannot say we've got to retreat. You cannot say we have to give up, we have to surrender. These words are not apparently American words. We cannot empathize with other nations because we don't get any votes from those nations. So here we have these two candidates trying to up each other. I'm a better manager to making America stronger is what Obama is saying. Romney, you're talking about submarines. You're talking about battleships and bayonets. I'm talking about, hey, he doesn't say it, but I'm talking about space warfare. I'm talking about cyber warfare. And the emphasis in the United States is to complete, full spectrum dominance of land, air, sea, space, cyberspace. And there's no question that we are there. Alfred McCoy, who's out in the audience, has written very eloquently about how dangerous and how powerful the United States is right now and will be as 2020 is a goal, 2025 is another goal. We're targeting the world. And we have, although we may be economically stagnant, we have the most power ever accreted in human history of any empire, including all the empires, Britain and Rome. We're far greater, stronger. And the American people don't know it. They keep, a lot of American people think, hey, we're the underdog in the Super Bowl here, and now we've come on and we're strong since the Soviet Empire. A lot of kids are born since 1989-91, so they don't even know a world where we were a lesser being. They assume so easily our dominance.
Peter, you're talking about founding myths, and you're talking right. about American exceptionalism, and they really go back a long way. John Winthrop, in his sermon aboard the Arbella in Massachusetts Bay in 1630, says America will be as a city upon the hill. The eyes of the world will be upon us. We're going to set the example for humanity. We've never gotten away from that idea. And so when we talk about American exceptionalism, we're talking about the idea that the United States is God's gift to humanity. Unlike other countries, we're altruistic, we're benevolent, we're generous, we only intervene in the world to spread freedom and democracy. Other countries are greedy, they want power, they want land, but we're different somehow. And as long as Americans hold to that kind of idea, then they justify all these interventions all around the world. And so, I mean, that's a fundamental myth that we're trying to debunk throughout this series.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, I mean, you have Obama in the beginning of the book seemingly in his mind recognizing that there's something foolish about this American yes. exceptionalism because, as you know, the British believe in British exceptionalism, the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism, but now as president, I mean, he's playing the trumpet of American exceptionalism as loud as anybody before him. Just in his inaugural address, he said, you know, God bless you and may he forever bless these United States of America. I mean, that's the same deal.
Well, are you going to stand up there and say, hey, no, we got to retreat? Like,
well, that's the point. I mean, can a president actually do that, or does the president have to keep spinning this myth?
Well, I'm asking you. I mean, what is the solution?
Well, presidents can do that. And there have been presidents who have stood up and gotten some understanding and recognition. One of the people we praise is John Kennedy. And John Kennedy enters office as the hardline cold warrior. I mean, he's really there in the Bay of Pigs. I mean, he's tough. In the beginning, and the Cuban missile, the missile gap, you know, was fictitious, but he ran and got elected on that. But after the Cuban Missile Crisis, we argue, Kennedy really did have a sincere and profound change of mind. And we see Kennedy as questioning the involvement in Vietnam. We see Kennedy as saying we need to end the space race. We see Kennedy as calling for a limited test ban treaty, and he wanted a full test ban treaty. We see Kennedy in his American University address in 63 calling for ending the Cold War. So it's possible, and we hold that hope for Obama still. We haven't given up on him. We would like to see a whole cabinet full of Chuck Hagels, which is not going to happen. But at least there are people there who have a different sense of what the role the United States should play.
I mean, there are a lot of missed opportunities in the history that you're portraying here. I mean, obviously the Henry Wallace, JFK. You have other missed opportunities. Yes. Carter came in, not an establishment figure, talked about nuclear disarmament, and then got kind of captured by the nuclear establishment. You have Reagan and Reykjavik with the nuclear weapons almost agreeing to that historic disarmament move, and yet they all seem to get swallowed up. Why is that?
Well, we have the first, after Wallace disappears from the scene, we have even Eisenhower. There's hope when Stalin dies in 1953. There's a peace branch offered seriously by new Soviet leaders, a new start. And Eisenhower seems to be for, and then a day or two later, John Foster Dulles gives a speech that, like, basically argues for the dismemberment again of the Soviet Union. And then in 1989, the same thing happens. 1989 and 91 is I remember that so vividly. There was so much, every single nation in the behind the Iron Curtain fell, and peacefully, without the internal dissent. It was a wonderful thing to witness. You were there, I imagine. And it was a special time in the world. And then behind the scenes, we now find out that Gorbachev was making tremendous concessions, allowing the dismemberment of Germany and so forth, and expecting something in return from Bush. He got words. He got vague promises. NATO was not expanded during Bush 41, but it was expanded under Clinton. onto the doorsteps of Russia and under Bush 43. But more importantly, at the very time, if you remember, it was like 2 months after the Berlin Wall that we invaded Panama. I mean, it was, and that was the day Born the Fourth of July opened, so I remember it very vividly because it affected our box office. But America, the concept of American triumphalism, which had started once again with Grenada in 83 with Reagan, came into its a new flowering from the from that period, from December 89 to through the 90s, it grew. We invaded Iraq within a year and 2 months. It was a, talk about a lost opportunity. Man, that was such a springtime. And I, in my lifetime, there'll probably be a few breaks, but I look at it like Peter does, like we're, history comes around again in another form. So we're hoping, you know, like a baseball player who gets another chance, three men on base, two out, bottom of the ninth, and you strike out, which is what Bush 41 did. We are hoping that, God damn it, the next time somebody in this audience is going to be in a little bit of power and a little bit of control. And you're watching your watch. You're like a quartet player. You're a triangle.
I got no watch.
We
got
to be careful here. We got to play the music.
It's Progressive Radio. You're listening to Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Gorbachev, you portray very well. And is it your belief he just hasn't gotten his due yet? I mean, I read polls from the old Russia where he's not really popular in his own country, which is weird to me.
Yes, it's stunning. In fact, Stalin is more popular in Russia than Gorbachev is. It's stunning to us. In fact, we're very proud of the fact that the first blurb we got for our book was from Mikhail Gorbachev. And he said, this is essential. This is what people have to understand. And Gorbachev has been pushing Obama to be bold. That's the thing that Gorbachev did. He was bold. He took a risk. You know, and in some ways, it didn't pay off for him personally, because people turned against him. But look what happened after Gorbachev in Russia. When Yeltsin gets in there, the standard of living collapses. The life expectancy plummets by over 10 years during that period. They become a third world country almost during the 1990s. There's basically a dictatorship imposed by Yeltsin. So, I mean,
they imposed capitalism on people.
Not just imposed capitalism, they did what they call shock therapy. And, you know, they took out the props from everything positive that had gone on there and subjected those people. The standard of living, according to some estimates, dropped 90%.
The equivalent 90%. Of a Republican election, in a way.
Especially in Wisconsin. You know, this is Walker writ large.
Right. I mean, it was the first taste of austerity for the Russians, anyway.
Have they sold the Capitol building here in Maryland?
Just about.
They will.
Naming rights are coming up soon, I think.
Naming rights. Space rights.
Another
It'll
theme.
Be called the General Electric Madison Avenue.
A really important theme in your untold history is the continuity of U.S. foreign policy, though. Even though there's these opportunities, missed opportunities, the continuity even from, in the book anyway, you start with the Spanish-American War with Hawaii and kind of draw a straight line to Iraq and Afghanistan.
It grows. It's like you know, the Blob, that movie, horror movies. We have when Bush the Bush 41 was a very subtle, but when Hussein invaded Kuwait, he sent troops very quickly to the Middle East, and that was like a carbon a major footprint we had in the Middle East with King Fahd acceding to those U.S. troops because they stayed, they didn't leave. There was no exit strategy. Our idea was to get troops into the Middle East. We expanded the wars, and we got all the way to the Far East. I mean, the Near East, rather, the Afghanistan, Iraq, all the oil-rich Caucasus and gas, and we never gave up. And we now all over the old former Soviet Union. And how do you stop it? You know, where does it? It just goes on.
I mean, that's the tradition. I mean, back to McKinley, where he said, you know, we have to go to the Philippines and Christianize these people, and he killed 200,000 or 500,000.
Well, that's an important turning point, because before that, the United States represented very different ideals. The ideology of republicanism, small-R republicanism, was dominant, and that called for rough equality of wealth, if we're going to have anything approximating democracy, and not being involved as an empire overseas. And there were big debates in the late 1890s whether or not we should get involved as an empire. And Bryan was strongly opposed to that in the 1900 election. But 1898 is an important turning point because the United States, for the first time, becomes a counter-revolutionary force. When we invade the Philippines, we're on the side of opposing popular government and democratic forces there. And then that's the beginning. And then we start intervening in Latin American countries one after another after another, and we sometimes stay decades in those countries.
I mean, one of the great things in the book and then in the series is you have one year after another with the invasions of Haiti and Nicaragua, and the map is just covered with dates in all of Central America and the Caribbean.
Yeah, it's very visual because people can see it on the map.
It's ironic that Ron Paul, who was a Republican nominee, was the only one in this modern era who has spoken so strongly against empire, and vividly to me. And it's he is a continuation of that Midwest Republican progressive mentality that it used to exist in not only William Jennings Bryan, but going on into George Norris, La Follette from Wisconsin. I'm sure you know
Gerald
him.
Gerald Nye.
Who?
Gerald Nye.
Gerald Nye, very important figure in the 30s. And Ron Paul said these things literally on the stage with eight other interventionist Republicans. So that was very brave of him. And he did get he drew quite a following of young people, whatever. So there is possible to say it still, and to perhaps in some way we can get closer to that position.
I'm speaking with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. Empire isn't talked about a lot in the United States, and to the extent that it was talked about in the last, 10 years, yeah. It was talked about as though the United States was the benign empire, the first benign empire ever. And it was ridiculous from where I was sitting, but why are they able to spin that myth?
Because right after 9/11, the country became very paranoid and fearful. And then when the United States invaded Iraq in the beginning, Bush was proudly proclaiming it, mission accomplished. This is a great thing, an easy victory. They're going to greet us in the street as liberators. The New York Times headlined this Sunday magazine section, January 5th, 2003. The headline was, American Empire, Get Used to It. So for now, the neocons, who in the past people had said, oh, we're not an empire, because it goes against our whole history and tradition. Now they say, yeah, we're an empire. We're the strongest empire ever. And we're benevolent. We're a great empire. And Max Boot says, we're the empire that everybody wants to join. In 2003, then things go a little south. People didn't notice in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then the idea of being an empire is not quite so attractive. And now you even got people like Robert Gates, Republican Secretary of Defense, CIA, saying that if the United States gets involved in another land war like this, we should have our head examined. MacArthur said this in the early 60s to Kennedy. And Kennedy, when people said to Kennedy, let's invade Vietnam, Kennedy would always say, well, go convince Douglas MacArthur and then come talk to me. So, but that, the people are realizing that. What a crazy strategy and policy we've had. But we're still getting involved, in more subtle ways, with this light footprint kind of strategy and with our drone attacks. God, we can start talking about drones and the implications of that, how dangerous that is now.
Well, this is continuity, too, with Bush. There was some drone warfare with George W. Bush. Now Obama has continued that. There were the kidnappings, which fortunately you debunk the hideous euphemism about extraordinary rendition. You call it kidnapping and torture. And there are subtler forms of torture still going on under Obama. So to me, the continuity, it just seems so overwhelming, the idea that we won't have another war, nor we won't have another land war, or we're the empire and we're not going to be there to take resources or land because we're a different kind of empire. It's just a joke, but it's a joke that keeps getting told.
It works, yeah.
It's a joke, but we understand what it's about. In 1948, George Kennan wrote an important memo in which he said, the United States is 6.3% of the world's population, but we consume 50% of the world's resources. How are we going to keep that disparity? He said, not by being idealistic and benevolent, but by pure power concepts. And that's governed our policy since, not the public impression, not the rhetoric, not the mythology, but it's governed the actuality of our behavior continuously, and it goes back to the 1890s, and yeah, it is bipartisan, sadly.
Oliver Stone, we seem to be a fading empire, though. What do you see as the future of the empire?
It's a very pessimistic question you're asking me, because we can be militarily powerful and economically weak, especially with space weaponry and space control. We have in 2006 we did not join the resolution of the rest of the world to try to neutralize space, to make it like atomic weapons. Israel and the U.S., I believe, voted against the resolution. So we are outliers. We haven't joined the concept of a nation of communities. We do not accept that idea, partly because of what American exceptionalism. We're better than these. We don't want to be in criminal courts. We don't want to belong to a. I don't really fundamentally believe we ever accepted the United Nations as a concept in this country. In fact, by the time Truman used it in Korea, to some degree, it was already politicized by the Russian. Sit out because of the Chinese not being admitted to the United Nations. The United Nations, it's a great idea. It's a great idea. And what's the solution? It's a very difficult one, you know, very difficult to arrive at. We can talk about it afterward, if you'd like, with the audience, because there are solutions, but they're never what you think they're going to be. You know, I foresee something unexpected, such as I can see military issues that can come to the fore, a coup d'etat, problems in the military, because it is like the Roman legions. The Roman Empire was built on bribes to the military.
A coup d'etat here?
Possibly, yes. And things that can go economically wrong. Certainly the Chinese have a leverage over us that the Russians never had. So these questions, we don't see them quite coming. But I don't think it's going to be this scenario of, I hope not space wars, where we're going to use cyber to blast out the Irans and possibly Chinas of the world, cut off all their communications, blind their armies, and perhaps resort to, you know, like the Star Wars image we used in Chapter 10, which is blowing up another country from afar with drones.
Peter, there is this so-called tilt to the east of the Obama administration now going after China. And, you know, I think 9/11 and the Iraq War and even Afghanistan is a kind of detour. Pentagon was always looking at China after the Soviet Union was falling. How do you see that playing out?
Well, in November 2011, Hillary Clinton wrote an article in Foreign Policy magazine called America's Pacific Century. And she and Obama and Gates and others have been talking about shifting our emphasis, getting out of Europe some, diminishing our footprint in the Middle East, and focusing on China. So we're talking about rebalancing our forces from 50% Europe, 50% Atlantic, 50% Pacific, to 60% Pacific, 40% Atlantic, number one. We're rearming all the countries surrounding China. It's the same thing we did with the containment policy of the Soviet Union after World War II. So we're containing China, squeezing on them, having joint naval and other military exercises with the Philippines. We're putting troops in Australia, naval exercises with Vietnam even. We're becoming friends with Myanmar. I mean, there's no limit to what we're willing to do to isolate and surround China now as the next frontier of our military aggression. And again, it's exactly the wrong kind of policy and approach. But Obama has been cheerleading this and intensifying it.
Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time for this little segment of Progressive Radio. I want to thank Peter Kuznick and Oscar-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone. They have this book out and this documentary series called The Untold History of the United States, which I can't recommend highly enough. It's the most radical thing I've ever seen on TV, and the book is terrific. You've been listening to Progressive Radio. I'll be back next week.
Thank you, Bill.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.